Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Al-Shabaab killed Somali soldiers in an attack on a military academy.
A military officer who did not wish to be named because he's not authorized to speak for the army told VOA 13 soldiers were killed and 20 others wounded as the soldiers lined up for breakfast.
We'll examine the impact on civilians of Sudan's 100-day-long conflict. A leading Ugandan opposition member is accused of betrayal after joining President Museveni's government. Nigerian authorities admit that 103 people died during anti-police protests. Liberia says its coast guard is conducting a maritime operation near its border where pirates have seized a Chinese-flagged vessel.
As I speak to you, there is an ongoing operation by the Liberian coast guard. They have already boarded the vessel and are carrying out an operation to secure the vessel and arrest the pirates.
And tensions are rising in Botswana between the LGBTQ and Christian communities. The stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. At least 13 troops were killed and 20 others injured in an attack by a suicide bomber on a military base's academy in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu. Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility. Analysts say the attack underscores security vulnerabilities in the military's fight against the militants. Ahmed Mohammed reports from Mogadishu.
A military officer who did not wish to be named because he is not authorized to speak for the army told VOA 13 soldiers were killed and 20 others wounded as the soldiers lined up for breakfast. The suicide bomber was among them. Analysts say the attack signals a weakness in the Somali army. Mahmoud Mohamed Igal is a security analyst at Somali Civic House, a policy research group based in Mogadishu. Igal says Al-Shabaab is confirming to the world that it has infiltrated the military and is even able to sneak dangerous weapons into a military installation. This also underscores its ability to undermine planned military offensive, thus weakening the military operations. Igal says Al-Shabaab seeks to weaken government positions ahead of a second phase operations against the group. Somalia's government says it plans to launch a second offensive against Al-Shabaab with the support of neighboring countries such as Kenya, Djibouti, and Ethiopia. He says the attack on Jalasiyad Academy is yet another significant message by Al-Shabaab to the Somali government. They are telling the government that the second phase of the operation will be tough and not as easy as the first one. Mahdi Musi Hassan, who teaches security studies at Mogadishu University, told VOA that Al-Shabaab's access to a military installation reflected badly on the image and the capacity of the Somali National Army. In the past, Al-Shabaab infiltrated security installations and highly guarded places, raising concerns the group has planted operatives within these circles. Hassan says the entry of an opposing force into a training base using a suicide bomber will soil the reputation of the government and its forces. It also damages the trust of the forces, the people, and the international partners. Hassan dismisses concerns that the increase in Al-Shabaab attacks is a result of the handover of forward operating bases by African Union troops to the Somali National Army. He says the recent Al-Shabaab attacks on the government and areas liberated during the first phase of the operations will not have an impact on security because of the handover by ATMIS, since all the operations in those areas were solely carried out by Somali and Kalan forces. The ATMIS, or African Union Transition Mission in Somalia, concluded its handover of all 7 forward operating bases to the Somali National Army by the end of June and withdrew an additional of 2,000 troops. This is in line with the expected exit of all African Union troops from Somalia by the end of next year. Security analysts warned the UN deadline could be ambitious given by Al-Shabaab's resilience and ability. Ahmed Mohamed, for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
Intense fighting continues in several parts of Sudan as the conflict between the country's army and paramilitary rapid support forces enters its 100th day. Asadullah Nasrullah is the spokesperson for the United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. VOA's Nabil Biagio spoke with him about the dire consequences that the fighting has brought upon civilians.
It obviously had a devastating impact, first of all, on the civilians of Sudan. Over 3 million people have been displaced within the country and also moved across the border to the neighboring countries in the region, including to Chad, Central Africa, Egypt, Ethiopia, in South Sudan. This includes more than 740,000 refugees and also refugees who were in Sudan before the conflict, mainly from South Sudan and some other countries who also returned back to their countries of origin. The countries where they returned to were also in difficult condition. In addition to that, 185,000 refugees who were hosted in Sudan were forced to flee and move from the states which were impacted by the conflict to safer areas inside Sudan. So, and also in total, I can say that 2.5 million people have internally displaced within Sudan. These are Sudanese displaced during these 100 days. So as you can see, this is the impact that we can highlight only on the part of the displacement. But obviously, the impact of the 100 days of conflict were beyond that. You know, the conflict has resulted in civilian casualties. In days, is also we have received reports of serious human rights violations, including sexual violence and other protection risks that faced by the civilians in Sudan.
I saw that many South Sudanese children living in Sudan, for example, White Nile State, have been hit by this measles outbreak. Is that correct?
That's correct. We have we have reports of nearly 300 South Sudanese children died because of the measles in malnutrition in White Nile State.
And of course, the human rights violations reported, which you were just telling me about, have been mostly reported in Khartoum, Kordofan, and Darfur, the areas hardest hit by the conflict. Is that what your reports say as well?
Exactly, because these are the areas, Khartoum and Darfur. In Darfur region, in Kordofan region, are the areas that are hardly hit by the conflict, and therefore we have more human rights violations in these states and regions.
And Asadullah, you are working in. Of course, you were forced to relocate to move out of Khartoum of Sudan. You currently working from Istanbul in Turkey. But the humanitarians in Sudan are working in difficult conditions. Fighting is going on. Now we have the rainy season is setting in. What are some of the challenges your team faces on the ground? And tell me about the status of your funding.
First of all, on the humanitarian situation inside Sudan, yes, the area, the space in the region that were hit hard by the conflict, it's very difficult for the humanitarian workers to operate. Accessibility is a serious challenge there, although we continue to maintain our presence where it's possible.
That was Asadullah Nasrullah, the spokesperson for the UNHCR in Sudan. He spoke from Istanbul with my colleague Nabil Biagio. In Uganda, a leading member of the opposition Democratic Party, the DP, says Norbert Mao, the group's leader, has relinquished his membership and position after he joined President Yoweri Museveni's government. Mao is now the country's justice minister after signing a cooperation agreement with President Museveni. But some of the leaders from the opposition party accuse Mao of betraying opposition ideals and its supporters. Dr. Lulu Bayiga is a DP member of parliament. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that a letter from President Museveni welcoming Mao to the government is proof that Mao no longer belongs to the opposition party.
President Museveni is not interested in the unity of this country per se. He's interested in co-opting voices of people that criticize him about how he rules this country. He could get unity of this country if he wanted to get the prominent people in various parts of this country, build consensus on national ethos, strategic priorities, and generally building consensus on governance and how people desire to be governed in order to cause the national unity.
Mr. Bahiga, some people are suggesting that that is what the president has been doing. A lot of your opposition political parties have been expressing their views freely in opposition to what he stands for. And he believes that the lack of unity and political divisions in Uganda has negatively impacted the progress that Uganda could have made with unity. Your take?
But how can you say that you have annexed a party with only 9 members of parliament and you boast that this is what unity is about, unity of the whole country? The National Unity Platform has the majority in the opposition. If at all it is about national unity, then he should be talking about the whole of the opposition. And this could have been done by listening to one another in a unity dialogue that we have been talking about, not merely silencing voices of criticism and killing opposition parties the way he's doing to DP, the way he's doing to FDC, the way he's doing it in NUP, the way he has done it in UPC. It is unsustainable the way he's doing it. That is what I am saying.
But Mr. Bahiga, last time I spoke with President Museveni, he talked about the platform where all political parties discuss issues of national importance, and that he has even made overtures to all political parties to come and hash out views about the best steps forward to, one, unite the country, and two, ensure the progress and build Uganda up. And that opposition groups have neglected it, then turn around and accuse him of trying to annex the political parties. What are your thoughts?
We had the interpolitical organization for dialogue, but he spoiled the chance to speak to opposition politicians. It is that, under that framework that political parties would come together and build consensus on how each of them is going to conduct itself in the face of Uganda and service of our country.
Dr. Lulu Bahiga is a member of parliament from the opposition Democratic Party of Uganda. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 25th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. VOA's English to Africa service celebrates its 60th anniversary on August 4th. Help us celebrate by sharing your thoughts on our programs. Send a voice message or a text to this WhatsApp number, +1 202 258 3076. Once again, +1 202 258 3076. Tell us what your favorite program is, or let us know about a particular news story that you connected with. Recall a favorite memory about VOA Africa and tell us what stories you think we should cover or how we can improve. Once again, the WhatsApp number is +1 202 258 3076. +1 202 258 3076. And we thank you for 60 years of support. Liberia says its Coast Guard is conducting a maritime operation about 10 nautical miles off its coast involving a Chinese-flagged vessel, the Shanghai 2. Eugene Nambwe, commissioner of the Liberia Maritime Authority, says pirates hijacked the vessel and are holding its Chinese crew hostage. He says there was an exchange of gunfire, but no casualty has been reported. In 2021, armed pirates kidnapped 15 sailors from a Turkish container ship off the coast of Nigeria. Nambwe tells me that as a coastal country in the Gulf of Guinea, Liberia has an obligation to intervene because piracy is becoming almost a regular occurrence.
On the 22nd of this month, in Sierra Leonean waters, a Chinese flag vessel, the NV Shanghai, was forcefully boarded by pirates. They then took the vessels out of Sierra Leonean waters. It is currently in Liberian water, but upon the incident, our Sierra Leonean counterparts contacted us, so our regional maritime rescue center took seize of the matter. And as I speak to you, there is an ongoing operation by the Liberian Coast Guard. They have already boarded the vessel and are carrying out an operation to secure the vessel and arrest the pirates.
You say pirates. Are you in touch with anyone on the vessel?
Already, officers of the military, the Liberian Coast Guard, have boarded the vessel in an operation. There has been exchange of gunfire. The Coast Guard managed to get on board the vessel. We have one of the pirates in custody currently, but it is still an ongoing operation as I speak to you. The Coast Guard is trying to totally secure the vessel and release the hostages.
Is this vessel flying Liberian flag?
No, it is a Chinese flag vessel. It is also Chinese owned. But under our responsibility as a flag and coastal state, we are under obligation to intervene in this matter because piracy in the Gulf of Guinea has become a very critical issue. In fact, this incident is the second in a few weeks in Sierra Leone. There was a previous one that happened much earlier, and then this incident with the NV Shanghai. So we cooperate along the coast within the Gulf of Guinea under several maritime agreements and architectures. So Liberia has a responsibility to intervene in any matter of piracy, particularly in our territorial waters. So the intervention by the Liberia Coast Guard is well within the ambit of the laws of the sea, and we are trying to save and prevent criminal activity on the seas.
Any identification in terms of the nationality of the so-called pirates?
Well, once we complete the operation, then we'll do identification. But what I can tell you is that the crew on board are all Chinese. We are in touch with the government of the People's Republic of China. And also the French Navy has a frigate that is patrolling the Gulf of Guinea. They provided support to the Coast Guard. So it's a joint operation because we have a regional center for us to coordinate activities. I just want to say that we are pleased that the Coast Guard have managed to board the vessel. And once the operation is complete, we believe all the crew will be safe and secure. So far, there has been no casualty, but there was exchange of gunfire on the vessel, which is currently located about 10 nautical miles off the coast of Cape Monserrate.
Eugene Nambwe is the commissioner of the Liberia Maritime Authority. You are speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Nigerian authorities have admitted that 103 people died in clashes with the military during 2020 protests over police brutality, a higher figure than previously given. Authorities in Lagos State also confirmed plans to conduct a massive burial for the bodies, which they say haven't been claimed by relatives. Survivors and rights groups blame the Nigerian military for most of the deaths, saying they opened fire on unarmed protesters. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Human rights group Amnesty International is among those calling for a new probe into the October 2020 deaths of protesters and told VOA Monday that it is investigating the government's claims. The Lagos State government said Sunday it plans to bury 103 people who died in the state during the various protests and relieve overcrowding in the morgue. The official statement came after a memo about the planned mass burial was leaked to the media. Activists are now accusing authorities of trying to cover up the extent of the casualties at the Lekki tollgate, the site of a heated clash between protesters and military forces. In response to critics, Nigerian government officials said Monday the bodies to be buried were rounded up from various clashes that erupted across the state, not solely from the tollgate. Lagos State officials said critics are trying to, quote, misinform the public, stir sentiment, and cause disaffection against the Lagos State government, end quote. Authorities said the measure was a routine exercise to decongest the public morgue and that the bodies remained unclaimed for nearly 3 years after being deposited there, despite public notices. Authorities added that none of the bodies were retrieved from the Lekki tollgate incident. Aminu Hayatu is Amnesty International's lead conflict and crisis researcher in Nigeria.
The leaked memo has triggered our intention to revisit this case of police brutality. especially the fact that we are the first that came out to expose during the answers the nature of the army's assault on protesters and the eventual killing of some of them, which was constantly denied by the Nigerian government. We are just being vindicated by the leaked memo.
In October 2020, thousands of young Nigerians poured onto the streets for 2 weeks to demand an end to what they called systemic police brutality and the notorious SARS unit of the police. The protests climaxed at the Lekki toll gate in Lagos on October 20th before security forces arrived and opened fire on protesters. In late 2020, during a hearing of an independent panel of inquiry, the military initially denied being at the toll gate, then later admitted soldiers were deployed, who fired blanks in the air to disperse the crowd. NSARS activist Obianuju Iluanya cast doubt on authorities' claim that the newly discovered victims were not from the toll gate shooting.
All of this is a cover-up. If we check, we might even see bullet wounds on them, proving that they were victims of 2020 massacre. So this is a clear-cut case of covering up for the police and covering up for the inadequacies of the government.
Hayatu says human rights must always be respected by authorities. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The United States imposed sanctions on three Malian officials on Monday, including the Minister of Defense, over accusations they facilitated the deployment and expansion of the Russian Wagner Group's activities in the country. According to Reuters, the U.S. Treasury Department said it imposed sanctions on Mali's Minister of Defense, Sadio Camara. It said he made several trips to Russia in 2021 to solidify an agreement between the Wagner Group and the Malian transition government. Tensions are rising in Botswana between the LGBTQ and Christian communities after a church-organized march on Saturday against a bill that could decriminalize same-sex relations. A 2019 High Court ruling supported LGBTQ rights in Botswana, sparking a backlash by conservative groups. Mkudise Dube reports from Habaruni.
The ongoing tensions come ahead of a National Assembly debate that is expected to begin this week on the controversial bill. But members of the LGBTQ community are not pleased with efforts by the religious leaders to influence legislators. Tato Muruti is the chief executive of the group Lesbians, Gays and Bisexuals of Botswana, or Lekakipo.
I also believe that the church may be starting a very dangerous trend by manipulating the legislators and the courts. It is important that we understand that the church's move may be causing some sort of destabilization of the democracy in the country, because they are trying to push this Christian fundamentalism on Botswana.
Muruti adds there is a need to find common ground instead of confrontation between the church and the LGBTQ community.
It is important that we push for non-combative approaches, especially with all organizations and all institutions. This, I believe, will allow for trust with stakeholders and also foster progress on common justice goals. It is also important to focus on issues of prevention and not redress. It is very important that we seek to prevent human rights abuses before they occur.
Handing a petition to Parliament during the weekend protest, Evangelical Fellowship of Botswana chairperson Bulafela Siele urged legislators to vote against the measure.
The EFB believes that if Parliament is to act as required by the bill, such an action will open floodgates of immorality and abomination in the nation, such as same-sex marriage, changes of school curriculum to teach our children such practices.
Botswana's High Court ruled in 2019 that laws criminalizing consensual same-sex relations were unconstitutional. Tia Morandao, the lawyer who represented the LGBTQ community in the 2019 case, says Parliament has no mandate to debate the bill, but instead must respect the judgment. But legislator Winter Mulutsi, who received the petition on behalf of the National Assembly, tells VOA it is now up to Parliament to decide.
The laws that we make are for the good governance of the Republic, and therefore I do not think the court can tell Parliament what to do.
There has been a pushback against gay rights in some African countries, with protests held in Malawi last week, while Uganda has passed stiffer anti-LGBTQ laws. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Haboroni, Botswana.
And that's it for this Tuesday, July 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us.